You're listening to the Untidy Faith Podcast, where we have honest conversations and gentle encouragement for when following Jesus gets messy. I'm your host, Kate Boyd, author, speaker, and gentle guide for Christians who are disentangling their faith from culture and desiring to find joy in following Jesus again. There can be life of faith after deconstruction. Let's find yours together. Welcome, everybody. We are taking on chapter 6 of 2 Samuel. I've got Liz and John with me again, as always. We've got some fist pumps. We're really excited. So, Liz, why don't you recap chapter 6 for us so we can jump in?
All right. So, chapter 6, we immediately following the war with the Philistines, David takes 30,000 of his best men to retrieve the Ark of the Covenant. And the Ark of the Covenant's kind of been in obscurity for the last 20 years or so. So now that David has a capital, he's got a place to bring it to, he wants to bring it back to a place of prominence, is kind of what he's thinking. So from the get-go, we know that they're not carrying the Ark the way that they should have been carrying it. The law was very specific. It needed to be up on poles on people's shoulders. They weren't doing that. They were carrying it on a cart with the oxen. And by the time they reach this like threshing floor location, the oxen trips, Uzzah reaches up to try to catch the ark because he's like, oh no, it's falling. God smites him and he dies. And David was big, big mad. He was unbelievably ridiculous response. Some commentaries say he was super confused. We'll talk about it later. But anyway, David's like, nope, call it off. We're pausing. We're not going to bring it. He leaves it at the house of Obed-Edom. So a few months go by and God is like blessing their socks off. We don't know all of what that blessing is specifically. Supposedly it's like having sons down the road that are super, super strong. But just blessing over and over. By the time David finds out about it, he is super jealous and he's like, nope, we're going to go get it. We're going to go bring it. We're going to figure out a way. We're going to go get it. So he goes out again to retrieve the ark. The second time that he goes, he's like, okay, we are going to make this the biggest performance of our lives. They are like sacrificing every 6 steps. They've got the instruments going. They are making this super, super big show. The ark's on the poles the right way that it's supposed to be. And they finally get back into Jerusalem. They're dancing. David's wearing this priestly garment, this ephod. And as they finally make it into Jerusalem, Michael's looking over from, you know, from her balcony or whatever, and she is pissed. She sees David coming in. She sees this big display with the ark and this, she's disgusted. And by the time they get all the way in the city, they have words. So David's presiding over these burnt offerings and these peace offerings. There's this big feast. And by the time everybody finally kind of goes back to their house at night, Michael calls David out and she tells him about himself. And David's response is to kind of taunt him his response is to taunt her with his theology, to kind of assert divine authority. There's all this like political tension and sexual tension and all this, just this irony. But they finally, it all ends by stating that Michael is never going to have children. And it's just kind of one final way that David chose to shame and humiliate her in a way that was very pointed at her. That probably nobody else in the country even realized at that moment.
Ooh. Yeah. Oh, so let's start with the ark. You mentioned, I think, so in 1 Samuel at some point, there was this episode where people looked into the ark or touched the ark and they were all killed. So this is a very, like, the precedent for this exists.
Yes.
This is the place where God sits, right? So you do not touch it. You are not worthy. Do the whole Wayne's World. We're not worthy. We're not, like, the whole thing.
Yes.
That's how it is. And so, yeah, I'm So bold move for these people to be like, you know, we've got this new thing we should try.
Well, and the Philistines transported the Ark on a cart.
We have a cart. Are we taking notes from the Philistines now?
Exactly. It's like, but wait, we have the law. We're just going to not. No.
Okay. So this immediately evoked, like, I got some cousins that could help. And you go and you get your, like, hillbilly cousins that are just like, no, man, we'll move it this way. No, David, we got a better system for you. We'll move it just like this. And just, like, kind of make it happen and don't follow the instructions. Where it's like, I don't think we should carry a refrigerator like that. Or it's like, no, man, we've been doing this for years. Like, there's a real, like, this newfangled cart is going to make it so much easier to move the ark.
Surprise, it does not work.
Something about that I thought was really interesting is, like, we know that the ark was supposed to be carried by the sons of Kohath. And here it says that they're being carried by the sons of Abinadab. And that word Abinadab means willingness. And I thought that was really interesting if we're looking at just, like, this relationship between willingness, like there are people that are willing to serve David and serve the king, and David being the leader that he is and knowing that he's essentially exploiting these people who are willing to violate the law to do what he wants to do, and he's not held responsible for it. And those are some of the big issues that I have with, like, the way that the whole chapter's mapped out. Like, from the beginning, if David's in the ephod, like, he's, like, having some sort of, like, spiritual authority in the whole situation, he's in the wrong from the get-go.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that sort of struck me in the whole chapter was the way that political and religious power and authority were continually interlaced, right, in the sense of David has established his political stronghold, his political capital of Jerusalem, and that's where he wants the religious center to be. So that's why he wants to move the ark there. And even though it takes a while, and all that stuff, like, he's working on that. But then he also has priestly garments, and he's helping with the sacrifices along the way, so he's doing some priestly duties, which may not have been unusual, you know, according to some of the commentaries, but I just keep getting struck again by how David continually wants to put these pieces together. When there were priests, right, and there were, like, prophets, and, you know, like we've mentioned Nathan last episode, who will later come out and, you know, rebuke David and things like that in a different piece of his story. But I think, so it's not like these things don't exist separately. It's just somehow, yeah, when they separated God from being their king, they then wrapped up king with the religious responsibility in some way too, or David really took a lot of that on. I would say even more than we saw with Saul in 1 Samuel, where there were some instances of him, like, having priestly garments or priestly duties or something. But here it's much more amplified with David. So there's even this, like, continued growth in that area, which obviously in these days makes me very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
With the way that we're putting those things together here.
To your point, like, once we get to the threshing floor, that's a literal place of separation. And I think that you're right that there's all of this, like, entanglement and this interwoven, these aspects between what's political and what's religious, and that the ox falls there in this place of separation. It's almost as if God's like, no, like, that's the wrong part here, is the trying to pair it all together, like, and also the other parts too. But, like, there's a whole lot of symbolic imagery there that really lends itself to, like, what you're saying right now.
David can't help himself to be in front and center of everything except parenting. It's like when there's something with his family, it's like, oh, I don't know what to do, hands off. And then he's like literally doing sacrifices in front of the Ark of the Covenant. Like, I'm a priest today. And is like dancing around like in his like. And so he really centers himself in the story over and over and over in the details. That I understand that a king would have had some religious responsibility. And I think I don't think it's crazy to think maybe the king could have performed some religious rituals just as kind of a like, yeah, sure, that's fine. Yeah. But like he's doing so much of like not being king. Like part of being, even if we wanted to just approach it from a sheer leadership perspective, he's absolutely not delegating. He's doing everything himself. And he's just like, nah, man, I'm right. This is good. And he's not letting his priest.
Well, and the spectacle of it, right? Like there's this, he's positioning it as though I am humiliating myself before the Lord by dancing. And it's like, no, you're doing it in front of everyone to try to show how blessed and how godly you are for bringing this in your midst. Again, it's one of those things where, like, when I was young, it was all very framed as, like, yes, I will become as undignified, even more undignified than this. Like, isn't there a song? There's a song.
He ruined the song. It's a fun song. I'll become even more undignified than this. Some may say it's foolishness. Na, 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 na. Hey!
We have, like, sort of given this episode in his life like this mythical lore, right, of what's going on, and the reality is that it's just it's not great, it's not good. We're not really, like, you really get the sense that, especially because what's right before it is that, well, his plan happened, someone died, oops, and then he puts it in someone else's house and good things happen to them. And so he's like, well, now I'll make a big show. And I want to make sure that everybody knows that the Ark is here. And that way I will also have good things. And surely God won't kill people on the way if we're celebrating him the whole time. And it'll all be me. And I'll dance around. And I'll do the sacrifice. Like, I'll do the whole thing. And it's like, dude, I don't know. Like, I used to be mad at Michael for what she said, but now I'm like, I get it. This is weird. You're not even, like you said, John, he's not being king. Like, of course. Yeah. You're not honoring yourself. You're making a spectacle of yourself so people think that you're holy and that maybe you can trick God into thinking that you're holy and blessing you because of these things that you do. But you're not really doing them for God. You're doing them for your own personal, like, prosperity and, like, success and power. Again, I'm shocked that these are, like, the ways that we choose to model our paths.
Yeah. I mean, something that's really interesting about, first of all, the fact that he sends the Ark to somebody's house, that's kind of shady because it just killed a guy. And then he's like,
I don't want to put that anywhere near me.
Yeah. Will you keep an eye out on this for me? Just heads up, don't open it or touch it, but I'm going to keep it with you. And then he gets jealous, I think, right?
Yeah.
He gets jealous and like, well, I want to be blessed. But I find it so interesting that in this, Obed, right? Obed Edom, the Gittite. There's really, like, I don't know much about him. There's not a much mention in the passage. The Ark isn't supposed to be with him, but God doesn't curse him for having the Ark. In fact, it seems like God may have blessed him for just keeping his hands off it. Just be like, okay, like, fine. Yeah, cool. I'm just not going to touch it, and I'm not going to mess with it, God. And so I think it's interesting that his blessings, to a certain degree, go outside of the rules to some degree in that regard, because he's not punished. Obed-Edom is not punished for David moving the thing, because it's all David. And then David gets jelly and is just like, okay, now we're going to pull out all the stops, and it's going to be about David. And he really is trying to win favor in the court of public opinion not with God. That, like, he's really just trying to impress the people. And it feels like this chapter lays it as bare as you possibly could. And in all sermons that I've ever heard about it, Michael is kind of painted as this, like, bitter, shrewish woman, right? But if we take a moment to empathize with her, she's been taken from her husband. So that's one. She's already been taken from a guy that she was with who chased her, who was like, please don't take her. No matter how the commenters tried to turn themselves into knots around that, right? Please don't take her.
Yeah.
He probably hasn't been sleeping with her. It doesn't seem like she's high up in the rotation of the wives and the concubines because yeah. She hasn't bore any children. So he already has wives. He steals another wife and then neglects her. And then he does this big old show. It's the Old Testament version. If he wanted to, he would.
Yes.
Right? Like, if he wanted to, he would. And she's just like, hey, man, like, what are you doing? My dad was king. Like, and we have to like, remember, she's not a stranger to this. She's been around royalty, like, her whole life. She was the daughter of the king and then now married to the king. And so she has some idea how this works. She's not just making stuff up because she's mad at her husband. She's just like, what are you doing? And then he basically, like, separates from her, right? And divorces her, and she just lives her life doing whatever. And it's really sad. But again, it's David. Is the family needed? Okay, I'm out. I'm going to go play priest for a little while.
Well, and I think the other thing that struck me when you were talking is, like, yeah, he wants the approval of the people. And if we look at the last chapter, when he was like, David perceived that he had the Lord's favor, was because he had another king's favor. And so he's almost completely conflated the favor of the people with the favor of God. Mm-hmm. And which is interesting, because that was also, like, Saul was chosen. Saul was, like, the guy, you know, he was the one who, like, seemed like the right king, and therefore kind of had the, you know, the opinion of the people and when he started. And so it's a really interesting metric for David to choose when he knows how fickle that is. And even he is chosen because that wasn't the right metric and it didn't work out for Saul. And so even, and then we see him responding by essentially refusing to bring peace to his own household, peace between the houses of Saul and David, and potentially the entire kingdom, uniting them through a kid, through Saul's line, which could have, you know, calmed things down. And maybe this is because I'm watching a lot of House of the Dragon right now, and so there's a lot of, like, marrying, having kids, political alliances, like, people agreeing for different things for peace in different places. So it's very, like, David really thinks that he has the favor because he's doing things in front of the people, and that he can kind of do what he wants as long as that's the case. And just the way he treats Michael, like, it's interesting that he's like, I will become more undignified than this. I will be more contemptible than this. And yet he strips her of one of her means of dignity by not giving her children.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And we don't know that for sure. It could just be, like, there could be the implication that her womb was closed. But it seems that a lot of people are like, no, it just kind of seems like they didn't reconcile. Like, after this conversation, he just didn't want anything to do with her. She was politically expedient, end of list. Like, that was it. And so he withholds her honor from her claiming he has all the honor in the situation.
For a man that has done some awful things, this is one of the most cruel things that he's done.
Yeah.
Just unnecessarily cruel. Because it's not like, and, you know, pardon me for taking maybe some liberties with, you know, old Eastern But like, he didn't ever have to be a good husband at any point. Like, yeah. these women were not asking a lot of him. I mean, for the most part, it seems like his kingly schedule was just who he was going to bed with that night. They weren't like going out on date night and playing with the kids together. Like, there was so little asked of him that what he does to her is needlessly cruel. And it's to punish her.
Yeah. One, if we go back, she's the only woman in scripture that ever loved a man. The scripture ever says loved a man. She loved him. And for her to not only be able to get over him after being in love with him, marry somebody else, then she's dragged back to him, and then he's going to abandon her, is cruel on so many levels that, and again, nobody else would have seen it. Just like an abusive marriage today, nobody else on the outside looking in is going to see those little digs that he's making at her, those, you know, snide remarks that he's whispering in her ear. And it just, it shows more of his character than just about anything else. And I also think, kind of pivoting slightly, but even like when we look at verse 16, and there are so many people that weaponize that passage to say, well, Michael was just making fun of David because he was dancing around in his underwear. One, that's not what's happening. Like, we know that. But also, if we're looking back at the Hebrew here, like, it doesn't say that. It's not saying that that's why. And a lot of our English translations have added that insinuation when it's not in the original text. And I think that that's another important kind of place where we can say translations have agendas, and it matters that we're faithful with our translation mm-hmm. and our interpretation, because that particular verse, even just by itself, has wide-reaching implications, especially for women, especially for victims of abuse, especially for victims of abuse in the church at the hands of powerful men. All of that is really, really important.
I'm team Michael now, man. I'm like, yes. I'm ride or die for Michael at this point.
I was about to say, I'm ride or die for Michael, too. Gosh, I like her a lot.
Is it, like, how devious do we think David is? Because if he has a baby with Michael, that is the presumptive heir.
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah. It's the daughter of the king with the current king. That is the presumptive heir. And so
it would be the smart move, right? Like, this could have brought a lot of peace to his whole life.
It's like his best friend's sister, right?
Yeah, that too. Even protected him when he left, right?
Yes.
Like, she helped him get away from her father. And just the way that he continually does not pay her back for, like, his life. He owes her his life, mm-hmm. and yet he steals her.
Well, and then by the time we get to chapter 9, where David says, is there anyone left in the house of Saul to whom I may show kindness for Jonathan's sake? Like, actually there is, like, your wife, like the one right there that you have been awful to, like, you could reconcile with her. This yeah. is the most logical answer to the question.
That's almost satirical. Like, right. like, we have to consider how much of, like, could this be satire? Like, could this be satire of a clueless David? Of, because who can I show kindness to? I don't know. How about your wife, buddy?
Ugh. And this may be because I watch a lot of Sister Wives, or did at some point. But yeah, there's definitely, like, this is why polygamy is complicated, right? Like, you end up not being able to focus, or, you know, there's just so much, like, there's so much pain and hurt that can be wrought in relationships because of the different dynamics that you introduce. Like, there's a point in the show where it becomes very clear that, you know, the guy is really only into one of the wives and keeps the other ones around because they mostly need the money and they have his children. But he doesn't hang out with the children. Yep. And so you sort of get the same vibe, like the ones who will call him on things or the ones who are like, actually, I need you to treat me better. He's like, well, it's just easy with Robin, so I'm going to stay with her. And you get a lot of like, So this sort of feels same vibe.
Not a big fan of resistance, David.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. All right. Takeaways. What we got?
Team Michael till I die now. Like, I found, this has helped me find a whole new empathy for her and who she was and what she was doing. But also within that, to not accept the time-honored reading of something just because it's time-honored. But to actually take the time to, like, investigate and look at it and really consider it.
Yeah,
I totally agree.
Liz?
I think by the time we get back to the arc, I can't help but think that David was probably terrified because he knew on some level it should have been his responsibility. Like, they were doing the wrong thing from the get-go, and only one dude who in his brain is trying to protect God, he's the one that gets killed by God. And I think on some level, I feel like David is both terrified because he thinks it should have been him because it was sort of his call, which is why he leaves the ark and abandons it and then comes back only when he wants something out of it. And he's trying to protect himself by making this big public display, like you said earlier. I think just my biggest takeaway is just to be very, very careful about our tendency to want to protect God without making sure we're in right relationship with God, without making sure that we're really walking the way that we're supposed to walk. Because again, you know, we have a whole lot of people that want everybody else to repent and want everybody else to change, but we're not willing to do that heart work. And that heart work is always going to manifest itself either in secret relationships, like in the case of Michael, and it's always going to fester and to get bigger, like we see down the road with this big, you know, very, very, very visible public downfall. And I think that from the beginning, we're seeing just the ways that all of this could have been prevented.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't get over the performative aspect of David in this chapter. I think it's the thing that I keep getting stuck on. And even in the way that, like, Michael is somewhat prophetic to him in, like, this is not what kings do. And I don't even think that she, like, only means that he's being undignified. I think there is a sense of, this is, you're not the man that I remember, right? This is not the David who was anointed king. And he's like, I'll do what I want. I'll be undignified if I want. I'll be contemptible. But look around. The people love me, so you can't do anything about it. And just for that, I'm going to punish you, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's this, like, deep sense of, he thinks that if he can perform his piety, that will equal his righteousness, his justice, it will prove his anointing. And man, if I can't relate to that sometimes, you know, and so I just keep getting stuck on this idea that he only feels like he's the Lord's anointed when he's getting something out of it, or when someone else sort of tries to come up next to him because they see him as a powerful person. Yeah. So he's really sort of confusing these things. And yeah, he just, you know, he makes a big deal out of all of this as though it's for God and it's really for him, because even his display, his pious display of, like, sacrifice and dance and spectacle of bringing the ark together is really because he thinks he'll be blessed because of it. And I think we just have to be really careful with what we think is happening and how we go about approaching that, and why we perform what we do, what's in it, and what are we performing? Does it really matter, right? because I'm not sure that the ark even needed to be moved, right? But he saw it as a way to consolidate his power by bringing in the religious arm, and we've all seen how that works out. Not great.
Not great.
All right. Well, where can we find you guys? John, where do we find you?
At John Pyle, JonPyle, on Twitter and on Threads. And my podcast is called Better on the Inside. There's an episode, two episodes, in fact, featuring Kate and Liz that you should check out.
All right. You can find me at Substack, Liz A. Day, LizADaye .substack.com. And I'm also on like Threads and Instagram, just at Liz A. Day, same spelling.
Yeah. And you can find me at kpoy.co on Instagram and Threads. And that also happens to be my website, where you can, pick up various resources on reading the Bible or getting nerdy about it as well. So come hang out with us. Thank you guys. And we'll see you next time.
Woo-hoo!